very simple. We wanted any government which would continue to fight. The generals, however, did not want to continue the fight. Rather, along with the prime minister installed as a civilian cover for the military regime, they wanted to move as rapidly as possible towards transferring the struggle for power in the South from the military to the political level, leading to a negotiated agreement among the Vietnamese parties themselves without American intervention. They saw the NLF as preponderantly non-communist in membership and largely independent of Hanoi's control, and regarded a political settlement among South Vietnamese as feasible in essential agreement with the official NLF program. But none of this was acceptable to the United States. President Johnson explained to Ambassador Lodge that his mission was knocking down the idea of neutralization wherever it rears its ugly head, because neutralism, as Ambassador Maxwell Taylor observed, appeared to mean throwing the internal political situation open and thus inviting communist participation in a democratic process here, as always, intolerable to the United States unless the right outcome is first determined by establishing a proper distribution of force. Ambassador Taylor feared as the worst outcome a government that would continue to seek a broadened consensus and would thus become susceptible to an accommodation with the Liberation Front. After the war ended, senior Pentagon legal advisor Paul Warnke observed critically in retrospect that for the United States to compromise and permit the indigenous forces of Vietnam to work their own way would be to condone the demise of the anti-communist regime we had supported in Saigon for 20 years. UN Secretary General U Thant initiated a negotiation effort in the fall of 1964 with the support of Moscow and Hanoi and in accord with the consensus of Vietnamese as well as others, but it was rebuffed by Washington. As for the media, it was not until after the die had been cast, not until March 9, 1965, after the United States had mounted its sustained air war against the North and landed the first U.S. ground forces in Vietnam, that the New York Times reported U Thant's 1964 efforts. The U.S. position throughout was that after, but only after, we have established a clear pattern of pressure could peaceful means be considered. William Bundy, August 11, 1964. His emphasis. First violence, then perhaps recourse to the peaceful means required by international law and the supreme law of the land. The elections provision of the Geneva Accords had been officially described in a 1961 State Department white paper as a well-laid trap that the United States had skillfully evaded, and planners were in no mood to fall into such a trap in 1964 until the use of violence had secured their objectives. Increasingly, U.S. planners turned to the policy of expanding the war to the North in the hope that this would compensate for their political weakness. No such conception of the evolving events and their meaning was ever made accessible through the mainstream media, which kept to the official line that the United States was pursuing limited measures to strengthen South Vietnam against attack by the communists, supporting South Vietnam against communist aggression. In the New York Times version, the United States was leading the free world's fight to contain aggressive communism, Robert Trumbull, defending South Vietnam against the proxy armies of Soviet Russia, North and South Vietnamese guerrillas, Hanson Baldwin, just as the French had fought a 7.5-year struggle against foreign-inspired and supplied communists. In early 1965, President Johnson decided to step up resistance to Viet Cong infiltration in South Vietnam, Tom Wicker. The Viet Cong infiltrate in their own country while we resist this aggression. Since the South Vietnamese guerrillas were trying to subvert this country, David Halberstam, it was natural that the Times supported the Strategic Hamlet program as necessary despite the coercion and brutality. It was conducted as humanely as possible to offer the peasants better protection against the communists, Halberstam, Homer Biggert. The peasant support for the South Vietnamese aggressors and the reasons for it were ignored. Hallin comments that in the entire New York Times coverage from 1961 through September 1963, he found two extremely brief references to land tenure. While the print media did on occasion reflect the perceptions and opinions of American military officers in the field, arousing much irate condemnation thereby for their anti-Americanism and negative reporting, television was more obedient. Thus, the head of the Pentagon's Public Affairs Office was able to assure Kennedy that the NBC network had been persuaded that it would be against the interest of the United States to show its coverage of rough treatment by South Vietnamese soldiers to Viet Cong prisoners, with a U.S. Army captain appearing in this sequence. NBC's news director undertook to withhold this film's scheduled appearance on the Huntley-Brinkley show and to keep it on the shelf so far as any other programs were concerned. Until the expansion of the war in 1965 began to provoke some concern, the NLF and DRV were treated almost exclusively as an arm of international communism, Hallin found in his analysis of the Times coverage. The term civil war began to be used in 1965, and the term aggression began to appear sometimes in quotation marks, referring to, of course, the Vietnamese aggression in Vietnam, the concept of American aggression being unimaginable then or since. But concern over Vietnamese aggression never abated, as when James Reston discussed the main point, how then is this aggression by subversion to be stopped, referring to aggression by Vietnamese against the American invaders and their clients. Similarly, on television, even more conformist than the print media, Peter Jennings, showing Pentagon films on U.S. air attacks, commented that this is the shape of things to come for communist aggression in Vietnam, while NBC's Jack Perkins reporting an Air Force attack that wiped out a village unabashedly advertising itself with signs and flags as a Viet Cong village justified the attack as necessary. The whole village had turned on the Americans, so the whole village was being destroyed. It is taken for granted that the Americans had every right to be marauding in a region of Vietnam where everything in this area for years was Viet Cong. A television report on Operation Attleboro described the fighting as raging once again to preserve democracy. Summarizing from the late 1940s, the United States supported the French War of Conquest, overturned the political settlement arranged at Geneva in 1954, established a terrorist client regime in the southern section of the country divided by foreign, that is, U.S. force, moved on to open aggression against South Vietnam by 1962, and worked desperately to prevent the political settlement sought by Vietnamese on all sides, and then invaded outright in 1965, initiating an air and ground war that devastated Indochina. Throughout this period, the media presented the U.S. intervention entirely within the framework predicted by a propaganda model. There are, of course, those who demand still higher standards of loyalty to the state, and for them, the fact that critical perceptions of American military officers in the field sometimes reached public attention is an intolerable adversarial stance reflecting the left-wing proclivities of the culture. Putting this interesting perspective to the side, as far as this period is concerned, we may discuss the conception that the media lost the war, although it would be quite accurate to conclude that they encouraged the United States to enter and pursue a war of aggression, which they later were to regard as a tragedy or a blunder, while never acknowledging their fundamental contribution to rallying public support for the policies that they were ultimately to deplore. Given the conformism and obedience of the media during this crucial period, when the basis for U.S. aggression was firmly and irrevocably laid, it is small wonder that public concern was so slight and that opposition was so negligible as to be entirely without significance. Only the most ardent researcher could have developed a moderately clear understanding of what was taking place in Indochina. Public attitudes after the bombing of North Vietnam in February 1965 in reprisal for an attack on U.S. military installations by the Viet Cong are therefore hardly surprising. Asked, "Who do you think is behind the attacks by the Viet Cong?" 53% blamed the Chinese communists and 26% blamed North Vietnam, while 7% said civil war. In no identifiable sector of American opinion would it have been possible even to ask the obvious question that would receive an easy and accurate answer in the case of the Soviet invasion of Afghanistan. Why do you think the Southern resistance is attacking U.S. military installations in South Vietnam? In fact, even at the peak of peace movement activities, or today, many years later, when it should be possible to observe the plain facts with some detachment, it would be quite impossible to raise this simple and obvious question, or to answer it, within the mainstream media and most of the culture. In this dismal record, we see clearly the consequences of mindless media obedience in a state with enormous resources of violence. 5.4. Reporting on the war. As the U.S. invasion mounted in scale and intensity, Indochina was flooded with war correspondents, many of whom reported what they saw and heard with honesty and courage. With rare exceptions, however, they gave an account of the war as perceived by the U.S. military on the ground or as offered in press briefings. In the home offices, Washington's version prevailed until elite divisions within the United States expanded the range of tactical debate. Reporters often did not conceal atrocities committed by the U.S. military forces, although they did not appear to perceive them as atrocities, and surely did not express the horror and outrage that would have been manifest if others were the perpetrators and the United States or its clients the victims. Malcolm Brown quotes a U.S. official who describes B-52 strikes in the South as the most lucrative raids made at any time during the war. Every single bomb crater is surrounded with bodies, wrecked equipment, and dazed and bleeding people. At one such hole, there were 40 or 50 men, all in green North Vietnamese uniforms, but without their weapons, lying around in an obvious state of shock. We sent in helicopter gunships, which quickly put them out of their misery. The Geneva Conventions require that members of armed forces who have laid down their arms and those placed hors du combat by sickness, wounds, detention, or any other cause shall in all circumstances be treated humanely, and there are no limits to the horror expressed until today over communist treatment of U.S. pilots captured during the air operations that leveled much of North Vietnam. But the victims that the New York Times is describing are Vietnamese carrying out aggression against Americans in Vietnam, so no such scruples are in order, and none were expressed. Similarly, there was little reaction when B-52 raids in the populous Mekong Delta were reported in 1965, with unknown numbers of civilian casualties and hordes of refugees fleeing to government-controlled areas because they could no longer bear the continuous bombings. The victims fell under the category of the unfortunate accidental loss of life incurred by the efforts of American military forces to help the South Vietnamese repel the incursion of North Vietnam and its partisans, as explained by Sidney Hook while condemning Bertrand Russell because he plays up these meritorious actions as deliberate American atrocities. No doubt one can find similar remarks today in Pravda, in commentary on Afghanistan by other commissars who are much admired as leading humanitarians because they courageously condemn the crimes of the United States and its allies in Soviet journals. Not only was there no reaction to these subsequent atrocities, but there was also no attempt to place them in the context of what had immediately preceded, that is, to make them intelligible. Indeed, there was little awareness of the background because the media were so closely wedded to U.S. government goals and perceptions that they never sought to learn the facts. As the war progressed, ample evidence became available from U.S. government sources to explain why the United States had been forced to resort to violence in the populous Delta, as elsewhere, as we described in the preceding section. But such materials, inconsistent with the preferred image of the United States defending South Vietnam from communist terror and aggression, had little impact on news reporting or commentary, except for occasional illustration of the difficulties faced by the United States in pursuing its noble cause. The reason for the U.S. resort to violence was overwhelmingly clear by the time of the outright U.S. invasion in 1965. And would have been no less clear before had any serious effort been made to determine the facts. As noted earlier, the United States was compelled by the political and social successes of the Southern Viet Minh, NLF, Viet Cong, to shift the struggle away from the political arena, where it was weak, to an area of violence, where it was strong, a typical response to a classic dilemma. It is in this context that we can understand the resort to B-52 raids in the populous Delta and elsewhere to destroy the civilian base of the indigenous enemy, expanding the failed efforts of the Strategic Hamlet program and earlier terror. The U.S. media continued to report the subsequent atrocities, but from the standpoint of the aggressors. One had to turn to the foreign press to find reports from zones held by the South Vietnamese enemy, for example, those of pro-Western correspondent Katsuichi Honda, who reported in the Japanese press in the fall of 1967 from the Mekong Delta, describing attacks against undefended villages by gunboats in the Mekong River and helicopter gunships firing away at random farmhouses, using the farmers for targets as if in a hunting mood. "They are hunting Asians." This whimsical firing would explain the reason why the surgical wards in every hospital in the towns of the Mekong Delta were full of wounded. His reports were available only to readers of anti-war literature, not the objective media, which had no interest in how the war might appear from the standpoint of the Vietnamese victim of the attack by the United States and the local forces it established. The media continued to observe and discuss atrocities blandly, not considering them as controversial or as raising any moral issue, in fact, not regarding them as atrocities at all, although we detect no such reserve with regard to the violence of official enemies. The respected columnist Joseph Harsh describes the frustrations of an American pilot dropping bombs into a leafy jungle with no visible result and without the satisfaction of knowing what he achieved. A hit on a big hydroelectric dam is another matter. There is a huge explosion visible from anywhere above. The dam can be seen to fall. The water can be seen to pour through the breach and drown out huge areas of farmland and villages in its path. The pilot who takes out a hydroelectric dam gets back home with a feeling of accomplishment. Novels are written and films are made of such exploits. The bombing which takes out the dam will flood villages, drown people, destroy crops, and knock out some electric power. Bombing the dam would hurt people. Nevertheless, it is better to bomb trucks, he concludes, although there would plainly be no moral barrier to the much more satisfying alternative rejected on tactical grounds. In the South, bombing of dikes and virtually limitless destruction was an uncontroversial tactic, as in the Batangan Peninsula, where 12,000 peasants, including, it appears, the remnants of the My Lai massacre, were forced from their homes in an American ground sweep in January 1969 and shipped off to a waterless camp near Quang Nai, over which floated a banner saying, "We thank you for liberating us from communist terror." The Times reported that the refugees had lived in caves and bunkers for many months because heavy American bombing and artillery and naval shelling had destroyed their homes, as well as a dike that was blasted by American jets to deprive the North Vietnamese of a food supply. It was left unrepaired, so that 2 years later, the salt water of the South China Sea continues to submerge the fields where rice once grew. The reason, according to an American official, is that the people were written off as communists, and for the same reason, the region was left in ruins. The hills that overlook the flooded paddies, once scattered with huts, are filled with bomb fragments, mines, and unexploded artillery shells, and B-52 craters nearly 20 feet deep pock the hills. Bombing of dikes in the North, occasionally reported, was controversial, as was the bombing of North Vietnam generally. The reason is that the cost to the United States might be high because of a potential Chinese or Soviet response, regarded as a serious and dangerous possibility, or because of the impact on international opinion. But these questions did not arise in the case of U.S. terror against the South Vietnamese, which therefore proceeded without notable concern, or, it seems, much in the way of planning. In the Pentagon Papers, we find extensive discussion and debate over the escalation of the bombing against the North, while there is virtually nothing about the far more destructive bombing, defoliation, destruction of vast areas by Rome plows, etc., in South Vietnam, where we were saving the population from aggression. With regard to South Vietnam, the planning record is limited to the question of deployment of U.S. troops, which again raised potential costs to the United States. The most notable exception to the easy tolerance of atrocities perpetrated against South Vietnamese was the My Lai massacre in March 1968, reported at once by the NLF among other massacres that are still not acknowledged or discussed. Details were disclosed in Paris in June 1968, but neglected by the media until November 1969, despite extensive efforts by helicopter gunner Ronald Reidenauer to publicize the story, which finally broke through to the general public thanks to the persistence of Seymour Hersh at the time of a massive demonstration in Washington, when media attention was focused on anti-war protest. The massacre was a footnote to the post-Tet accelerated pacification campaign, and minor in context. More revealing was the massacre at nearby Mekay, with 90 civilians reported dead, discovered by the Peers Panel inquiry into the My Lai massacre. Proceedings against the officer in charge were dismissed on the grounds that this was merely a normal operation in which a village was destroyed and its population murdered or forcibly relocated, a decision that tells us all we need to know about the American war in South Vietnam, but that passed without comment. While the nation agonized about the sentencing of Lieutenant William Calley for his part in the My Lai massacre, a new ground sweep in the same area drove some 16,000 peasants from their homes, and a year later, the camp where the My Lai remnants were relocated in this operation was largely destroyed by air and artillery bombardment, the destruction attributed to the Viet Cong. These events, too, passed with little notice, and no calls for an inquiry, reasonably enough, since these two were normal and routine operations. Medical workers at the nearby Canadian-run hospital reported that they knew of the My Lai massacre at once, but gave it little attention because it was not out of the ordinary in a province, Quang Nai, that had been virtually destroyed by U.S. military operations. The highest-ranking officer to have faced court-martial charges for the massacre, Colonel Orrin Henderson, stated that every unit of brigade size has its My Lai hidden someplace, although every unit doesn't have a Ridenhour to expose what had happened. Knowledgeable elements of the peace movements also gave the My Lai massacre no special notice for the same reasons. The reasons why this particular massacre became a cause celebre were explained by Newsweek's Saigon bureau chief Kevin Buckley, referring to Operation Wheeler Walawa with 10,000 enemy reported killed, including the victims of My Lai, who were listed in the official body count. An examination of that whole operation would have revealed the incident at My Lai to be a particularly gruesome application of a wider policy which had the same effect in many places at many times. Of course, the blame for that could not have been dumped on a stumble-bum lieutenant. Calley was an aberration, but Wheeler Walawa was not. The real issue concerning this operation, Buckley cabled to the U.S. Office of Newsweek, was not the indiscriminate use of firepower, as is often alleged. Rather, it is charges of quite discriminating use, as a matter of policy in populated areas, as in this operation or many others, among them Operation Speedy Express, with thousands of civilians murdered and many others driven to refugee and prison camps by such devices as B-52 raids targeted specifically on villages. An experienced U.S. official, cited by Buckley, compared My Lai to the exploits of the U.S. 9th Infantry Division in a range of similar operations. The actions of the 9th Division in inflicting civilian casualties were worse. The sum total of what the 9th did was overwhelming. In sum, the horror was worse than My Lai. But with the 9th, the civilian casualties came in dribbles and were pieced out over a long time, and most of them were inflicted from the air and at night. Also, they were sanctioned by the command's insistence on high body counts. The result was an inevitable outcome of the unit's command policy. In short, the My Lai massacre was ignored when it occurred, and the substantial attention given to it later is a more subtle form of cover-up of atrocities. An honest accounting, inconceivable in the media or the culture generally, would have placed the responsibility far higher than Lieutenant Calley. But it was more convenient to focus attention on the actions of semi-crazed GIs in a gruesome combat situation with every Vietnamese civilian a threatening enemy. My Lai did not prompt the media generally, there were some individual exceptions, to take a deeper look at the nature of the war or to display an interest in reports of similar events in nearby areas that suggested its unexceptional character. This particular massacre was made exceptional by an arbitrary cutoff of attention and refusal to investigate beyond narrowly circumscribed limits. The limited but dramatized attention to My Lai was even used to demonstrate the conscience of America in the face of enemy provocations. Thus, a 1973 New York Times report from My Lai describes the battered Bataungan Peninsula, an area where the inhabitants were generally supporters of the Viet Cong, now demolished by U.S. bombardment and ground operations. Big guns fire into the peninsula, as they have again and again over the 8 years that American, South Korean, and South Vietnamese forces have been trying to make it safe. The report quotes villagers who accuse the Americans of having killed many people here. They are in no position to appreciate what the name of My Lai means to Americans, the reporter adds thoughtfully. The standard critique of the media for having lost the war identifies television as the major culprit. Television analyst Edward J. Epstein formulates the standard view as follows. Over the past 10 years, almost nightly, Americans have witnessed the war in Vietnam on television. Never before in history has a nation allowed its citizens to view uncensored scenes of combat, destruction, and atrocities in their living rooms, in living color. Since television has become the principal and most believed source of news for most Americans, it is generally assumed that the constant exposure of this war on television was instrumental in shaping public opinion. It has become almost a truism and the standard rhetoric of television executives to say that television, by showing the terrible truth of the war, caused the disillusionment of Americans with the war. This has also been the dominant view of those governing the nation during the war years. Depending on whether the appraisal has come from hawk or dove, television has thus been either blamed or applauded for the disillusionment of the American public with the war. There have been several studies of the matter, suggesting a rather different picture. We will return to some of these issues in discussing the coverage of the Tet Offensive, but we should observe that there are some rather serious questions about the standard formulations. Suppose that some Soviet investigators were to conduct an inquiry into coverage of the war in Afghanistan to determine whether Pravda should be blamed or applauded for the disillusionment of the Soviet public with the war. Would we consider such an inquiry to be meaningful without consideration of both the costs and the justice of the venture? Epstein notes an obvious logical problem with the standard view. For the first 6 years of television coverage, from 1962 and increasingly through 1967, the American public did approve of the war in Vietnam, according to polls. Furthermore, in a 1967 Harris poll for Newsweek, 64% of the nationwide sample said that television's coverage made them more supportive of the American effort, and only 26% said that it had intensified their opposition, leading the journal to conclude that TV has encouraged a decisive majority of viewers to support the war. Epstein's review of his and other surveys of television newscasts and commentary during this period explains why this should have been the case. Up until 1965, he writes, the network anchormen seemed unanimous in support of American objectives in Vietnam, and most described themselves as hawks until the end, while the most notable dove, Walter Cronkite, applauded the courageous decision that communism's advances must be stopped in Asia in 1965 and later endorsed the initial U.S. commitment to stop communist aggression wherever it raises its head. In fact, at no time during the war or since has there been any detectable departure from the unqualified acceptance of the U.S. government propaganda framework. As in the print media, controversy was limited to tactical questions and the problem of costs, almost exclusively the cost to the United States. The network anchormen not only accepted the framework of interpretation formulated by the state authorities, also were optimistic about the successes achieved in the U.S. war of defense against Vietnamese aggression in Vietnam. Epstein cites work by George Bailey, who concludes, the results in this study demonstrate the combat reports and the government statements generally gave the impression that the Americans were in control, on the offense, and holding the initiative, at least until Tet of 1968, a picture accepted by the network anchormen. Television focused on the progress of the American ground forces, supporting this picture with film supplied by the Pentagon that showed the bombing of the North and suggesting that the Americans were also rebuilding the South, while they were systematically destroying it, as could be deduced inferentially from scattered evidence for which no context or interpretation was provided. NBC's Huntley Brinkley report described the American forces in Vietnam as builders rather than destroyers, a central truth that needs underscoring. What made this especially deceptive and hypocritical was the fact, noted earlier, that the most advanced and cruel forms of devastation and killing, such as the free use of napalm, defoliants, and Rome plows, were used with few constraints in the South, because its population was voiceless, in contrast with the North, where international publicity and political complications threatened, so that at least visible areas around the major urban centers were spared. As for news coverage, all three networks had definite policies about showing graphic films of wounded American soldiers or suffering Vietnamese civilians, Epstein observes. Producers of the NBC and ABC Evening News programs said that they ordered editors to delete excessively grisly or detailed shots, and CBS had similar policies which, according to former CBS News president Fred W. Friendly, helped shield the audience from the true horror of the war. The relative bloodlessness of the war depicted on television helps to explain why only a minority of the Lou Harris Newsweek poll said that television increased their dissatisfaction with the war. Such coverage yielded an impression, Epstein adds, of a clean, effective technological war which was rudely shaken at Tet in 1968. As noted earlier, NBC withdrew television clips showing harsh treatment of Viet Cong prisoners at the request of the Kennedy administration. Throughout this period, furthermore, television coverage focused most exclusively on the American effort. There were few interviews with GVN military or civilian leaders, and the Viet Cong and North Vietnamese were almost non-existent on American television newscasts. There was one famous exception to the sanitizing of the war. An August 5, 1965 CBS report by Morley Safer showing U.S. Marines burning huts in the village of Cam Ne with cigarette lighters, which elicited a semi-official campaign by the Pentagon to discredit the television story and vilify the correspondent as unpatriotic. But surveys of television newscasts by Epstein and Wisconsin professor Lawrence Lichty show that instances shown on TV of American brutality toward the South Vietnamese, such as Cam Ne, could be counted on one hand, Lichty, even though hundreds of South Vietnamese villages were destroyed during this period. The Cam Ne story is famous for being the exception to the rule. Returning soldiers told a different story, and it became increasingly clear, although not through the medium of television, that the war was bloody and brutal, leading to disillusionment, and among a large sector of the general population, increasingly out of control, a much stronger and more appropriate reaction. But Epstein continues, "The televised picture of gradual progress in the war was abruptly shattered by the communist Tet Offensive in January-February 1968, when the military lost its control over the movements of the press, who could step outside their hotels and find themselves willy-nilly in the midst of bloody fighting. For this brief moment, correspondents sent on-the-spot reports that were aired in place of the usual carefully edited view of an orderly controlled war, and the policy of shielding American viewers from the grisly close-ups of wounded Americans, body bags, and death briefly collapsed, though newscasts continued to be edited in home offices as too strong," in the words of NBC producer Robert Northshield. This coverage convinced Walter Cronkite that the war had become a bloody stalemate in a controversial report to which we will return. The Tet Offensive convinced U.S. elites that the war was becoming too costly to the United States, and the government shifted toward the policy of Vietnamization, large-scale massacre operations to destroy the indigenous resistance and its civilian base, expansion of the war in Laos and Cambodia, and the commencement of negotiations with North Vietnam. Accordingly, the networks again changed the focus of their coverage, this time from the battlefields in Vietnam to the negotiation tables in Paris. The story was now the negotiations, not the fighting, Northshield explained, adding that combat stories seemed like a contradiction and would confuse the audience. Similar decisions were made at the other networks, Epstein adds, as all altered their coverage in late 1969 from combat pieces to stories about the Vietnamization of the war and the negotiations in Paris. The post-Tet accelerated pacification campaign, one of the most crucial and murderous operations in the U.S. war against South Vietnam, received little attention. Epstein believes that there is a marked difference between the coverage of the formative years of the war, 1962 through 1967, and the later years when the anti-war movement was at its height. Up until 1968, television coverage was controlled to a large extent by the American military, and generally it reflected a controlled American initiative which seemed to be winning the countryside and decimating the Viet Cong. The searchlight rarely focused on related questions, such as the sufferings of Vietnamese civilians. During the Tet Offensive, the focus changed to Americans shown in the defensive, endangered and helplessly frustrated, then to the story of the American withdrawal as negotiations began at the end of 1968. The differences, however, are misleading. Apart from the live coverage during the Tet Offensive, there was very little departure from the principle that the war must be viewed from the standpoint determined by official Washington doctrine, a standpoint that broadened in scope after Tet as tactical disagreements arose within elite circles. In his survey of network newscasts from 1965 through the January 1973 peace treaty, Daniel Hallin reaches similar conclusions. Until the Tet Offensive, television coverage was lopsidedly favorable to American policy in Vietnam, well beyond even the remarkably docile print media. Like Epstein, he notes the dramatic change after Tet, part of a larger change, a response to as well as a cause of the unhappiness with the war that was developing at many levels, from the halls of the Pentagon to Main Street USA and the firebases of Quang Tri Province, and much more crucially, the unhappiness that had become quite significant by 1968 among business elites, leading to the changes in U.S. government policy already discussed. Before Tet, editorial comments by television journalists ran nearly 4-1 in favor of the administration policy. After Tet, 2-1 against, reflecting divisions in the establishment itself. He quotes New York Times editor Max Frankel, who said in an interview that, "We're an establishment institution, and whenever your natural constituency changes, then naturally you will too." The same was true of television, and it is hardly surprising, and quite in accord with the propaganda model, that its fervent loyalty to the administration changed when the establishment bastards have bailed out, as Lyndon Johnson put it bitterly after the wise men advised him in March 1968 to abandon hope of military victory and to de-escalate the conflict in the wake of the Tet Offensive. Television typically presented events in terms of a kind of morality play, a dramatic contrast between good, represented by the American peace offensive in 1966, and evil, represented by Hanoi. Reporting was relatively bloodless, focusing on the successes of the good guys, American boys in action, regularly depicted as brave men, the greatest men in the world, heroes, exuding competence, humanity, and high morale as they fight against communist aggression in the battle for democracy and win hearts and minds by caring for sick and injured civilians after a village was burned and blasted to death. Properly, because ammunition had been found there, which was good enough proof of its being used by the Viet Cong. Greg Harris, NBC TV, October 27, 1967. The issue of racism was apparently too sensitive to touch, Hallin adds, noting that he found no comment on the hostility that many American soldiers felt towards all Vietnamese, a prominent theme in veterans' recollections of the war. The focus of coverage was the Americans, soldiers bravely defending Vietnam, medics caring for the wounded, pacification officials rebuilding after the damage for which communist terror bore responsibility. Our South Vietnamese were virtually ignored, with virtually nothing on political, economic, or social affairs, and the peasant figured in the news mainly as a victim and prize of the conflict. The political opposition in Vietnam was portrayed with considerable hostility, like the anti-war movement at home. They were forces of anarchy on the march. Walter Cronkite, CBS TV, March 31, 1966. The utterly fraudulent elections were portrayed as a triumph as democracy, courageously carried out in defiance of the disruptive attacks of Viet Cong terrorists. Civilian casualties were downplayed or regarded as unavoidable side consequences of a job that had to be done, raising no moral question. Observing an airstrike on a village of unabashed Viet Cong supporters after a column of American soldiers had drawn fire, NBC's Jack Perkins commented, "There was no discriminating one house from another. There couldn't be, and there did not need to be. The whole village had turned on the Americans, so the whole village was being destroyed, as is only right and just." In a follow-up on the Cam Ne incident, Dan Rather offers a comment that Hallin cites as an example of a muckraking tone, the harshest he presents. The Marines are holding Kamnay by force, not through the pacification program, which hasn't taken hold in Kamnay. And until it does take hold here, and a lot of other places in South Vietnam, nobody can feel very good about this dirty little war. In short, as long as there is still resistance to American violence, we cannot feel good about proceeding with our necessary chores. Such comments as these presumably account for Rather's reputation among the Doves as a courageous opponent of the war and among the Hawks as a dangerous leftist. Walter Cronkite reported an urgent plea from the Viet Cong for medical and surgical supplies to the International Red Cross, an indication that our bombing raids and infantry sweeps are taking a heavy toll on all kinds of Red equipment. Reporting of civilian casualties rose from 1966 to a peak in early 1968, then declined sharply as the United States turned to the murderous accelerated pacification campaign, which Hallin does not discuss, presumably because it was largely ignored by television, which had shifted attention to the negotiating tables in Paris in accordance with Washington priorities. The coverage rose again in 1972 when casualties could be attributed to a North Vietnamese offensive and the U.S. response. In a 1971 CBS documentary entitled The Changing War in Indochina, Charles Collingwood reported the progress of the pacification campaign in Kien Hoa province in the Mekong Delta, once an NLF stronghold, Hallin observes. This province had been the target of Operation Speedy Express in early 1969, one of the most brutal American operations of the war in an area that had been organized under NLF control with no known North Vietnamese presence, conquered through the awesome firepower of the 9th Division. This included airstrikes using napalm, high explosives, and anti-personnel bombs, B-52 bombing, and artillery shelling around the clock at a level that is impossible to reckon, with armed helicopters scouring the landscape from the air night and day and accounting for many and perhaps most of the enemy kills, about 11,000 according to the U.S. command, with 748 weapons captured, a fair indication of who was killed. Collingwood was pleased to observe progress in pacification, although there was still Indian country beyond. This is almost like St. Louis on the move into the frontier, his companion, a U.S. government advisor, replied, in a reference that is more accurate than he probably knew. In contrast to the heroic and humane image of the American soldiers defending democracy, the NLF and North Vietnamese were portrayed in an almost perfectly one-dimensional image as cruel, ruthless, and fanatical. Of 12 positive comments by journalists that he found throughout the war, Hallin remarks, 10 concerned the effectiveness of enemy forces. This was the only element of television's image of the enemy that changed substantially in the course of the post-Tet shift, mirroring establishment qualms about the prospects for the success of American arms. What did not change was the dark picture of evil. When U.S. forces burned villages, this was a necessity because they provided cover and support for the Viet Cong. The results of B-52 saturation bombing were a tragedy of war. But when a North Vietnamese artillery shell hit an orphanage in An Hoa in October 1970, ABC's George Watson commented with horror, "No one was prepared for the massacre, the irrational murder that the North Vietnamese inflicted on An Hoa." Although civilian casualties were overwhelmingly the result of U.S. firepower, attribution of responsibility by television was weighted by a 10-7 ratio to the account of the enemy. Its calculated policy of terror contrasted with the unfortunate but legitimate side effects of U.S. operations. Even military operations of the enemy were terrorism. Reporting on a Viet Cong ambush of an American patrol, ABC's Peter Jennings recounted another of those small but, and here he paused a moment for dramatic effect, harrowing VC butcheries, October 1965. The North Vietnamese and Viet Cong were portrayed as savage, brutal, murderous, fanatical, suicidal, half-crazed, mere vermin in areas that were communist-infested or Viet Cong-infested, and thus had to be cleansed by the American liberators. The style and technique are familiar in state propaganda of all varieties. Overall, Hallin concludes from his survey, television never veered from the official interpretation of the war as a struggle to defend democracy against aggression. In the early years, it was taken for granted that we would surely win, not only because we were more powerful, but because the right was clearly on our side. Television held this view strongly, perhaps more strongly than the public itself. It didn't work out that way, and eventually television brought the bad news. But it never explained why. It never re-examined the assumptions about the nature of the war it had helped to propagate in the early years. So, to the public, the bad news must have seemed nearly as incomprehensible as an earlier American defeat in Asia, the loss of China. Attribution of the American failure by the public to treason or lack of American will caused by the failure of the media to support our just cause with sufficient fervor is therefore hardly surprising. This may well explain why the public has apparently been willing to accept the tales about media treachery. But among the educated elites, the explanation may lie elsewhere, in a totalitarian cast of mind that regards even the actual level of media subservience to the state as inadequate and a threat to order and privilege by the forces of anarchy on the march. 5.5. Some crucial events of the war. 5.5.1. The Tonkin Gulf Incident. By mid-1964, there was a growing consensus among Vietnamese in favor of a negotiated political settlement, while the United States was maneuvering with increasing desperation to evade what internal documents describe as premature negotiations. The reason, as frankly explained, was that the United States was politically isolated, in opposition to the NLF, the non-communist opposition, and even the generals. It was therefore regarded as necessary to expand the war to the north to obtain the DRV's cooperation in bringing an end to the Viet Cong insurgency and to persuade or force the DRV to stop its aid to the Viet Cong and use its directive powers to make the Viet Cong desist, Ambassador Maxwell Taylor. Intelligence, meanwhile, concluded that the basic elements of communist strength in South Vietnam remain indigenous. U.S.-run military operations against North Vietnam began on February 1, 1964, Op Plan 34A, using South Vietnamese and third-country mercenaries, presumably mostly nationalist Chinese, according to Cahin. These operations were officially designed to result in substantial destruction, economic loss, and harassment. On July 30th, 31st, Saigon Navy vessels attacked North Vietnamese islands, eliciting an official DRV protest to the International Control Commission on July 31st. The USS destroyer Maddox, conducting an electronic espionage operation in that general area, entered the 12-mile zone regarded by North Vietnam as its territorial waters on August 2nd. The Maddox was challenged by North Vietnamese patrol boats, fired warning shots, and was hit by a single bullet in the ensuing battle, in which the patrol boats were damaged or destroyed by the destroyer and U.S. aircraft. On August 3rd, Secretary of State Dean Rusk sent a secret cable to Ambassador Taylor stating that, "We believe the present Op Plan 34A activities are beginning to rattle Hanoi, and Maddox incident is directly related to their efforts to resist these activities." The Maddox was returned to the area along with the destroyer Turner Joy on August 3rd, and on August 3rd and 4th, Saigon naval vessels bombarded North Vietnamese coastal facilities, quite possibly one that the destroyer's electronic surveillance had activated and located, Cahin observes. There was some indication that the U.S. destroyers might have come under attack by North Vietnamese patrol boats on August 4th, although Captain John Herrick of the Maddox was unsure, and radioed that reports appear very doubtful and that there were no actual sightings by Maddox, recommending complete evaluation before any further action. Subsequent evidence indicates that almost certainly no attack took place. On August 5th, President Johnson publicly denounced the open aggression on the high seas against the United States of America by the North Vietnamese, while the DRV and China stated that the so-called second Tonkin Gulf incident of August 4th never occurred, Chinese government statement. On August 5th, U.S. planes bombed North Vietnamese installations and destroyed North Vietnamese patrol boats. after testimony by Defense Secretary Robert McNamara, in which he falsely claimed that the Maddox was operating in international waters, was carrying out a routine patrol of the type we carry out all over the world at all times. Congress passed a resolution authorizing the president to take all necessary measures to repel any armed attack against the forces of the United States and to prevent further aggression. 416-0 in the House. Wayne Morse and Ernest Gruening alone in opposition in the Senate. This August 7th resolution was subsequently exploited as the basis for the escalation of the U.S. attack against Vietnam. The Gulf of Tonkin incident, Hallin observes, was a classic of Cold War news management. On virtually every important point, the reporting of the two Gulf of Tonkin incidents was either misleading or simply false, and in accordance with the needs of the U.S. executive at that crucial moment. The New York Times had reported sabotage missions against the North as recently as July 23rd, and reported Hanoi's August 2nd protest of an attack on North Vietnamese villages by Laotian Air Force planes. But neither the Times nor the Washington Post mentioned these facts, either at the time of the incidents or in the weeks that followed, aside from inconspicuous sidebars on Hanoi's allegations, which were accurate but dismissed, and a passing reference in a column by James Reston. The reporting was objective in that it correctly reported U.S. government statements, raising no question about them, presenting no relevant background, and marginally citing communist denials while proceeding to report the events as Washington wished them to be perceived. In subsequent weeks, the Times published a number of brief references to what was charged or asserted in the generally accurate reports from North Vietnam, which were rejected and dismissed by reporters, while front-page stories and headlines presented the false Washington version as fact, with much speculation about Hanoi's motives in sending a few patrol boats to attack the mighty U.S. 7th Fleet. The relevant background continued to be ignored or buried with marginal references in back pages. The criticism by Senator Morse was barely mentioned and dismissed. There was no hint of administration doubts that the August 4th incident had even taken place. The news weeklies adhered still more rigidly to the government propaganda line, even providing vivid and dramatic accounts of the August 4th incident, which apparently never took place. The accurate criticism by Senators Gruening and Morse received a few lines, dismissed as predictable responses by the irascible Morse. There was no interest in their charge that the Tonkin Gulf resolution had been predated, also dismissed by the Times without inquiry. North Vietnamese and Chinese reactions were dismissed as bluster by communists who boiled with hatred and hostility toward the U.S., Newsweek, and propaganda blasts, U.S. News and World Report. None of the weeklies considered the possibility that U.S. actions might have provoked the August 2nd incident, or that there were doubts in Washington about the August 4th attack, although some of the relevant facts had been briefly noted. For example, Time, July 31st, noting missions inside North Vietnam by parachuted sabotage teams. The U.S. government version was simply adopted as unquestioned truth, with no further discussion or inquiry necessary. There were ample grounds at the time for suspicion about the U.S. government version. The foreign press was able to see that serious questions arose. Le Monde presented public statements on all sides and an analysis of what the public record indicated. Neither the Times nor the Post made any such analysis of the record, simply taking the false Washington version to be correct and dismissing the accurate communist allegations with a bare mention. In London, the New Statesman covered the U.S. and Chinese versions, including the accurate Chinese account of the U.S. Saigon actions that preceded the incidents, and the charge that the first was provoked by Washington while the second never occurred, and concluding that the incidents in Vietnam do not seem quite as simple as the initial headlines indicated, a substantial understatement. In the United States, the left-wing National Guardian, with five major articles, and I.F. Stone's Weekly provided the most extensive, careful, and accurate account of the events. In contrast to the fevered rhetoric of the mainstream news weeklies, the National Guardian simply described the facts that were available, asking whether the August 2nd skirmish had been provoked and whether the alleged August 4th incident had taken place. The relevant background and communist versions were accurately presented, with appropriate questions raised. Wayne Morse's commentary was given ample coverage, as were South Vietnamese General Ki's statements on sabotage missions in North Vietnam. I.F. Stone's Weekly also reported the facts accurately, adding relevant background ignored by the major media. In summary, the national media, overcome by jingoistic passion, failed to provide even minimally adequate coverage of this crucial event, although appropriate skepticism would have been aroused in the mind of the reader of the foreign or alternative media, or the reader with the sophistication to treat the media as a disinformation system disguising a reality that can perhaps be ascertained with sufficient energy and dedication. The Pentagon Papers analyst describes these events as an important firebreak, noting that the Tonkin Gulf resolution set U.S. public support for virtually any action. The willingness of the media to serve as a vehicle for government propaganda helped impel the country toward what they were later to regard as the tragedy of Vietnam. The reaction of Congress and the public laid the basis for the outright invasion of early 1965, providing support for the planners who were secretly concerned that the NLF was continuing to seek a political settlement favorable to the communists through the device of neutralism and a coalition government. Maxwell Taylor, August 10, 1964, and who warned about Saigon and Vientiane hanky-panky with Reds, John McNaughton, October 1964, that is, moves toward a political settlement in accordance with the NLF program as described by intelligence, to seek victory through a neutralist coalition rather than by force of arms. When the United States extended the war in early 1965 to try to salvage its position in the South, the media continued to offer total support, in accordance with the guiding principle of American foreign policy since 1945, as outlined by the distinguished liberator commentator of the New York Times, James Reston, that no state shall use military force or the threat of military force to achieve its political objectives. And the companion of this principle has been that the United States would use its influence and its power when necessary and where it could be effective against any state that defied this principle, which was at stake in Vietnam, where the United States is now challenging the communist effort to seek power by the more cunning technique of military subversion. In the Orwellian world of American journalism, the attempt to seek a political settlement by peaceful means is the use of military force, and the use of military force by the United States to block a political settlement is a noble action in defense of the guiding principle that the use of military force is illegitimate. The United States then proceeded to fight a long and brutal war to try to achieve its objectives in Vietnam, demolishing much of Indochina in the process and leaving a legacy that may never be overcome. Finally, in January 1973, the United States formally accepted a peace treaty that was virtually identical with the Vietnamese consensus it overturned by violence in 1964, except by that time, the indigenous NLF had been effectively demolished and little remained in Indochina outside of North Vietnam, laying the basis for North Vietnamese domination of Indochina exactly as had been predicted long before by the wild men in the wings. The media bear a major responsibility for these tragic events. Coverage of the Tonkin Gulf incident with its congressional blank check for further aggression serving as a notable example. 5.5.2 The Tet Offensive. Media coverage of the Tet Offensive has been the centerpiece of the critique of the media for losing the war by their incompetent reporting and their anti-government bias reflecting their passion for confronting authority. The authoritative proof of this contention was provided in the two-volume Freedom House study by Peter Braestrup. Conducted over a six-year period with a wide range of distinguished participants and consultants, and support acknowledged from some two dozen corporations and labor unions, this study was hailed as a monumental work by Don Oberdorfer in a Washington Post magazine cover story on the 10th anniversary of the offensive with the title, Tet, The Turning Point, How a Big Event on Television Can Change Our Minds. Professor John P. Rausch of the Fletcher School of Law and Diplomacy of Tufts University, intellectual in residence for the Johnson administration, described the Freedom House study as one of the major pieces of investigating reporting and first-rate scholarship in the past quarter century, a meticulous case study of media incompetence, if not malevolence. In a relatively critical discussion in the Times Sunday Book Review, Edwin Diamond praises this painstakingly thorough study of how the Vietnam War was presented to the American public by its leading image makers, a highfalutin epistemological quest by a conscientious reporter-analyst that raises profound questions about how do we know what we know, revealing the biases introduced by standard journalistic assumptions and organizational practices that contributed to undermining the U.S. position in Vietnam among the general public and Congress. Similarly, Charles Moore reports that in a conference of aging hawks and doves on the 10th anniversary of the Tet Offensive at the University of North Carolina, journalism came in for some strong criticism and only a rather muted defense. The criticism was by Braestrup, who expounded gently on the theme of his recent book, Big Story, and the hawks in attendance, while some of the reporters there demurred only softly. The study is regularly cited by historians without qualification as the standard work on media reporting of the Tet Offensive, in some respects as important as the battle itself, here analyzed in depth, R.B. Smith. Oberdorfer, too, accepts the conclusions of the study as proven. It was the big event on television that changed our minds about the war. The only commentary he cites, even obliquely, accepts this judgment, Roche and others unnamed. Within the mainstream more generally, it is assumed with little question that this remarkable scholarly contribution made its case, though one may debate whether it revealed malevolence or deeper problems of standard journalistic assumptions and organizational practices, reflecting perhaps the adversarial stance of the media with regard to established power. Braestrup claims to have shown that the reporting of the Tet Offensive is an extreme case of the unsatisfactory performance of the media. Rarely has contemporary crisis journalism turned out, in retrospect, to have veered so widely from reality by presenting a portrait of defeat for the Allies, allies being the term regularly used to refer to the U.S. invaders, the local forces they organized, and the largely mercenary forces they introduced to support U.S. military operations in Indochina, and a term chosen to exploit the favorable connotations provided by World War II when the Allies fought the Axis. To have portrayed such a setback for one side, them, as a defeat for the other, us, in a major crisis abroad, cannot be counted as a triumph for American journalism, which shouted that the patient was dying, then weeks later began to whisper that he somehow seemed to be recovering, whispers apparently not heard amid the clamorous domestic reaction to the initial shouts, with television the worst offender. The whispers began about late February, he asserts. These journalistic failures, Braestrup concludes, reflect the more volatile journalistic style spurred by managerial exhortations or complacence that has become so popular since the late 1960s, accompanied with an often mindless readiness to seek out conflict, to believe the worst of the government or of authority in general, and on that basis to divide up the actors on any issue into the good and the bad. The bad actors include the U.S. forces in Vietnam, the military-industrial complex, and the CIA, among others, while the good, in the eyes of the media, are presumably the communists, who, Braestrup argues sardonically throughout, were consistently overpraised and protected. The prospect, he foresees, is for a continuation of the current volatile styles, always with the dark possibility that if the managers do not themselves take action, then outsiders, the courts, the Federal Communications Commission, or Congress, will seek to apply remedies of their own. A proposal taken up in Roche's call for a congressional inquiry and the subsequent warnings of the Trilateral Commission cited earlier. The Braestrup Freedom House thesis has two essential components. One, coverage of the Tet Offensive illustrates media incompetence and their adversarial stance. Two, by the portrayal of an American victory as a defeat, the media bear responsibility for the loss of American resolve and the subsequent American defeat in Vietnam. It is the second component of the thesis that carries the dramatic impact, and that has permitted it to set much of the agenda for subsequent discussion of the Fourth Estate and the dangers that its newfound power and 60s style of mindless hatred of authority pose for the very survival of free institutions and democracy. The first component of the thesis is commonly accepted even by those who deny the second. Thus, rejecting the stab-in-the-back thesis, George Herring nevertheless observes that the media was hostile to the war and to Johnson seems clear, and much of the reporting of Tet was misleading. These distortions of the media may have contributed to growing popular discontent with the war and public anxiety, Herring adds, but these were not the operative factors in Johnson's decision to de-escalate and seek negotiations after Tet. An analysis of the facts and the argument demonstrates that neither component of the Freedom House thesis is tenable. The second, as we shall see, is conceded in the Freedom House study to be false with regard to public opinion, and the straw at which they then grasp will plainly not bear the weight. As for the first component, on the narrow question of professional competence in reporting the facts available under trying and confused circumstances, the performance of the media was acceptable, if not outstanding, and compares quite favorably to the internal reporting of the American military authorities and U.S. intelligence, insofar as these are available. But when we turn to broader questions of the sort discussed earlier, that is, if we evaluate the media by the standards that we would probably apply to reporting, say, on the Soviet invasion of Afghanistan, we see that indeed they can be faulted in precisely the terms anticipated by the propaganda model. The very example